Welcome to the Foolish Racing Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 12:50 p.m. the Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought it would kick off this week with the combined deficit spending indicator that I've created. I'm starting off with it because it takes forever to load the chart. But I think the clear conclusion here is that we had a big uptick in deficit spending in 2008. Prior to that, we'd had, in fact, a significant amount of fiscal contraction. And we even had, on a global basis at least, a budget surplus right ahead of the big problems that happened in 2008. And at that point, global deficits spun out to about $1 trillion. Well, then we also had a very mild process of fiscal consolidation globally. Obviously, it's if we were to look at individual regions, then some would have had more fiscal consolidation than others. But certainly from the beginning of 2018 onwards, we've had a very significant fiscal stimulus. And it's still at $1.5 trillion. But earlier this year, it was north of $2 trillion. So over the course of the last 6 months, we've had some reticence among investors and, well, I guess primarily among governments to expand the size of their stimulus in an aggressive manner. That's as true of the USA as it is of Europe and elsewhere. Now, different countries are approaching this issue from different perspectives, but the reality is that on an aggregate, we are seeing that deficit spending has contracted, and that represents something that is detracting from global liquidity. Now, when we then think about how willing are central banks to increase the size of their balance sheets, well, then that's an additional and, I think, in many respects, symbiotic relationship. That's one of the things I think that has occurred as a result of the coronavirus, is that we are getting these symbiotic relationships between government and central banks. It's really not all that long ago that central banks gained their independence from governments. As recently as the 1990s, the Bank of England was very much influenced by the UK government. Then they've had independence. Now we're trending back towards less independence. The Federal Reserve has been quasi-independent from politicians for almost a century, but the existence of the US presidential cycle gives the lie to that claim that it's fully independent. But one thing we can say is that the total assets of central banks have continued to expand. But certainly also the pace of the advance has moderated. So we had a very swift increase in the total assets of central banks in March and April, but since then it has moderated, and the pace has continued to moderate over the course of the last 2 months. So the flow of additional liquidity has also been curtailed over the course of the last 2 months. Now we need to think about the dollar. The dollar index has at least stabilized. It pulled back really very abruptly from the high in mid-March, immediately following the lockdowns, to new lows over the course of the last few months. But it's trading today pretty much around the same place it was back in August. Every time the dollar takes a dive, then that increases liquidity to the global markets, but not necessarily at home. One thing that we've certainly seen this week is increasing enthusiasm among investors to look at Asian currencies. The Asian dollar index has been strong all week. It's now testing the peak from earlier this year. It's in the process of breaking its sequence of lower rally highs. Well, what we can then conclude is that, yes, there is a willingness to expand deficits, but not so much lately. There is a willingness to increase the size of central bank balance sheets, but not so much lately. But there is certainly a desire to devalue the dollar. And that is certainly a more pressing factor overall, because the Asia dollar index peaked in 2011. That's 9 years ago. And it's a particularly lengthy period of underperformance for currencies. Generally, trends in the currency market don't usually last more than about 3 or 4 years, because a big move will generally elicit some form of support or weakening mechanism from central banks and government. But Asian currencies have been trending downwards now, with the short-term exception of the rally in 2017, for 9 years. So it's I think a good time to start thinking about, well, what are the medium-term outlook, or what's the potential for Asian currencies? Because if the dollar is trending downwards, and it does look increasingly likely that the dollar will continue lower. But of course, happiness in the currency markets, and this has been one of the things that David had said repeatedly, is having the trend and the central bank on your side. Well, the Federal Reserve has pretty much stopped increasing the size of its balance sheet. But the government of the USA is aggressively increasing the size of the deficit. Now, there is a lot of back and forth horse trading going on in the present moment, because there is a determination, I think, by politicians. They don't want to see the stock market rally, or at least one party doesn't want to see the stock market rally in an aggressive manner heading into the election, because that would hand an advantage to President Trump. They would perhaps much more prefer that the stock market deteriorate, the economic outlook moderate over the course of the next 6 weeks, so that it might help the chances of the Democratic Party to get elected. At least investors are behaving in that regard. Now, there are a number of different calculations about what the ramifications of the US presidential election are likely to be. But neither, let's run through what those are. It could be that the status quo is maintained, that President Trump wins, the Republicans hold the Senate, and the Democrats hold the House. So that's divided government, and generally when we have divided government, then the stock market does reasonably well, because it reduces the potential for big change. On the other hand, if the Democrats win a clean sweep, then that would increase the potential for some change, but the divergences within the Democratic Party between the very progressive left-wing almost communist fringe and the moderates is so wide that that could also potentially curtail the potential for significant change. But what happened? No one is in fact giving any credence whatsoever to the potential that the Republicans could win a clean sweep. Now, it does look very unlikely, particularly in view of all the polling, but one does have to question how relevant polling is these days. One thing that also I think is quite likely is that the number of court cases contesting the results in counties and states all over the USA is likely to be really very aggressive. The hanging chads and the repeated counts in parts of Florida from 2000, I think, were simply a preamble to the main event that we're seeing 20 years later. There is going to be a very acrimonious dispute about how to count the votes because of the reliance on mail-in voting, the ineptitude and inability of the U.S. Postal Service to provide the service that's being required of them on such short notice. And then that does hold out the potential for some form of volatility around the event. And potentially that now is what stock markets are beginning to price in. Now, one thing we can certainly look at in terms of the S&P 500 is that the reaction we've seen over the course of the last month is relatively similar in size to the one that we saw in June. And so far, The region of the 50-day moving average is continuing to offer support. The S&P 500 has recouped most of today's decline to finish in the region of the 50-day moving average. I think it's important to think about short, medium, and long-term ways of looking at trends, because when we look at the short-term trend, then obviously the most attractive short-term trends are those that have got the clearest momentum, and they then tend to provide some of the most consistent trends. So momentum generally creates consistent trends. So the 50-day moving average tends to be among the most compelling from the perspective of a momentum investor, someone who is trading on a leveraged basis. And certainly we've had some pullback in terms of the willingness of the highly levered investors to become active in this area, because it's been messing around now for 2 weeks. Some people have been thinking, well, golly, it must be because a lot of the retail traders who were very active in the market in the summer have gone back to school. Some might be thinking that it's because the football season has started up again, so that they're now betting on football games again. But then, of course, there was the other point that SoftBank was a very significant participant in the massive options positions that were taken out over the summer. And they have unwound those positions. So now the question is, where are the additional speculative flows going to come from? Well, there would be no shortage of speculative flows in the event that we get stopgap spending measures, or we get a willingness from the Federal Reserve to increase the size of its balance sheet. But perhaps they're not willing to do that at the 50-day moving average. So we're still in an environment where there is potential for dip buyers to come back in this area. And the number of, important asset classes that have paused in the region of their 50-day moving averages is quite high. So the NASDAQ is now trading below it, and a significant number of the mega cap shares have also pulled back below their respective 50-day moving averages. So this is very short term in nature. If we then go out and look at longer term charts, well, then we can see that there is ample evidence of a very clear acceleration. When we look at these longer term charts, then a 200-day moving average is often among the best ways to look at it. But I have also tended to favor looking at the 1,000-day moving average on a longer term basis as well. But I particularly like the 1,000-day moving average when we look at lots of back history, but then I think also importantly to look at a logarithmic scale chart. So what is the difference then between log scale charts and arithmetic scale charts? Well, one is important to an investor, the other is important to a trader. Log scale charts show us percentage gains. So an unleveraged investor is going to be much more attuned to what's happening in terms of the log scale. When we look at the log scale on Apple, for example, and then put a 1,000-day moving average on it, well, on the one hand, we can certainly see that there have been multiple occasions on which the price found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But what we can also see is that even on a log scale chart, we have got acceleration. So the pace of the advance has been really quite spectacular on a short-term basis, up from the lows in March. In fact, the pullback in March did not quite get to the 1,000-day moving average, and subsequently it has rallied incredibly impressively, and not especially on any new news, other than the short-term boost that it's had from the coronavirus. Certainly, there has been a backlog in terms of the company's ability to get products out. And that's obviously beneficial in terms of cash flow in the short term. But we, I think, have to pay some due consideration that the estimated PE is trading at 33. So this is really quite an extraordinary increase in the valuation for the share. It's not quite the same as other companies that had had extraordinarily large PE ratios which have contracted. Most of the valuation that Apple has attained, where it got all the way up to 2 trillion and wasn't able to hold it, has been done through valuation expansion. So that, I think, does help in terms of the longer term perspective, that when we look at the very long term, then a 1,000-day moving average is a good trend mean from the perspective of a long-term investor. When we're thinking about a trader, then they're looking at momentum. And when you're thinking about momentum, then that almost implies that there is also a degree of leverage, and therefore their tolerance for pullbacks is lower. The 200-day moving average is even too far away, so they tend to look at 50-day moving averages. And that failure to support to find support in the region of the 50-day moving average is a warning shot. Now, I do think that it's relevant to pay attention to these kinds of long-term comparisons, because when corporate profits have been pretty much going sideways for 6 years, but EPS has been rising, well, part of the reason why it rose is because the number of shares has decreased, even though earnings have been relatively stable. So that has increased EPS. But these kinds of extraordinary divergences don't tend to last indefinitely. So the big question, therefore, is, are we going to see a rebound in corporate profits? Well, we could, but in order to see that rebound in corporate profits, well, then we're going to have to get through to a clear reflationary trade. And what we are starting to see is that classic industrials are starting to perk up. So GE is right in the region of its lows from all the way back in 2008. It's trading at a fraction of where it traded in 2000, and the business is a fraction of what it was in 2000, considering the number of disposals they've had to go through. When we then think about some of the big chemical companies, then they've also pulled back aggressively, but have rallied to push back above the trend mean and are continuing to hold that move. So there is the potential for reflationary trades. When we think about some of the big industrials that are heavily linked to the aeronautics sector, well, Rolls-Royce is still trending downwards. They are diluting the shares because they're going to be printing more of them and also issuing more debt. So that is leading to additional downside. Boeing had planes falling out of the sky ahead of the pandemic, so it's still experiencing some difficulty in its recovery. But the big question, therefore, is, if we're going to have a reflation, what exactly is going to be reflated? Well, it's quite likely we're going to have infrastructure development, most particularly in the housing sector. So Toll Brothers, for example, has just about unwound all of its decline, and it is right in the region of the peaks over the last few years. Home building is likely to be a crowd pleaser just about everywhere, because one of the most significant issues for the millennial generation, who are increasingly going to dominate the electoral rolls over the course of the next 20 years, is the affordability of housing. So we're likely to see a great many more homes that are built over the coming years. We also need a great deal of infrastructure development. And the renewal that we're seeing in the commodities complex is pointing towards that. The continuous commodity index was in additional positive territory in here today. It's in the process of breaking this sequence of lower rally highs. Well, when we think about the infrastructure that's going to be built, we can think about roads and bridges and dams that need to be replaced. That and those are rather urgent because they are falling down, and that is true of just about everywhere that invested significantly in infrastructure in the aftermath of the Second World War. But then we have new infrastructure that's also being put in place. So we're definitely seeing that there's a lot of interest in the solar sector, and the solar sector has rebounded impressively from the lows put in March, and it broke out to new recovery highs over the course of the last 2 months. Now, we certainly have some pause and consolidation going on right now, but it's outperforming the wider stock market, and while we may yet have some additional pause, then it's likely to be something that can be bought on the dips going forward, because the clear trend among investors and among the voting public is to support renewables. On the one hand, we've got improving technology. Improving technology is revolutionizing the energy sector. When we've got in the lab, at least from the Aalto University in Finland, they've got solar collectors that are achieving 130% efficiency. And they're already moving towards manufacturing. So that's something that is potentially very, very, I think, transformative in terms of the kind of things that can be produced in the next 5 years. The UK government is, for example, is talking about becoming a carbon-free country in terms of energy production within 5 years. And they're starting to produce, or they're starting to level out the demand profile for electricity with batteries. Well, Tesla is, in many respects, a regulatory arbitrage company. So that is one of the primary reasons why the share remains firm. It's not so much about the sales of vehicles, but they are likely to have their battery day next week. And that battery day is obviously a lot is going to hinge on exactly what is produced. The company does have a bit of a record of fluffing some of these big announcements. I think a lot of people will remember that when they announced the Cybertruck and they said that the windows were going to be waterproof, or excuse me, were going to be bulletproof. And then he hit it with a hammer and it shattered. Well, obviously, that wasn't a particularly enthusiastic or a very encouraging development. Investors are expecting that Tesla will deliver a million-mile battery. Now, that's particularly important because the resale value of electric vehicles has been awful. Teslas have got the highest resale value of any vehicle, because they are still in they're in high demand and limited supply. Eventually, that will change, and the degradation of the capacity for charging in the batteries will then become a much more significant factor. Tesla has concluded that range is the least of their problems, and the sustainability and charging capacity of the battery is much more relevant. And from a resale point of view, for the majority of consumers, it is much more important, because if people are buying cars primarily to commute with, then at a range of 300 to 400 miles is plenty. But if you pay $30,000 for a vehicle and it's worth five within 10 years, or within 4 years, then that's obviously a very significant devaluation. Teslas at the moment are holding up very well, better than any other vehicle. with a million mile battery, then the rationale for why the value of the vehicle should decline over time will be significantly weakened. So it's very important that they do announce the rollout of these new battery chemistries, not only to enhance range, but also to enhance sustainability of the product. And of course, that will also give them additional benefits in terms of their green credentials, because the need to replace a battery every 3 or 4 years is obviously something that should be a point most people should be concerned with, because we're talking about big batteries with volatile components that are difficult to recycle. The longer the battery lasts, the better it is for the environment. But it is this clear trend towards introducing batteries and storage into the electricity grid. And then by introducing batteries, reducing the reliance on fossil fuels is something that, regardless of whether it makes money or not, it is being supported by the evolution of carbon taxes. Well, we've already got carbon pricing in Europe, and this is a sector that has got clear government backing. And at one point this week, it was testing its all-time highs. Now, we did see some weakness coming through in terms of carbon credits at the end of the week, and we may yet see some additional consolidation. But the Europeans want to have higher carbon prices. In the USA, California is the only state that has got a heel-to-toe full carbon trading platform. There are 12 other states have got some form of carbon trading, but the big point is that the more electric vehicles you have on the road and the greater fuel efficiency of vehicles, it means that they're consuming less fuel, and governments all over the world are losing out on that revenue stream. Well, it would be bad enough in normal times, but they're now running massive deficits. They need to come up with new taxes to figure out how to close those budget gaps. And carbon pricing is an ultimate sin tax. And there is the potential that they are going to look at carbon pricing in much the same way that they look at taxing cigarettes or alcohol. So if that's the case, it is going to represent a significant challenge for the conventional energy sector. But what we are seeing is that oil prices have been firming. What we've seen this week is oil bounced from $40 but paused in the region of the 200-day moving average today. Eventually, oil prices will rebalance. Our oil supply demand fundamentals will rebalance, and then prices can start to appreciate. We're still in an environment where the coronavirus has not been completely dispelled, and there is the threat of cases rising again in places like the UK or Spain or Israel. Well, Israel went into a full lockdown in here this week, but that's also because their deaths are now higher than back in March. In the UK, they're talking about introducing additional constrictions because the cases are rising, but there's been no movement in the number of deaths. So it really then depends on the demographics of who is getting the virus and not. Stock markets responded extremely favorably to the provision of liquidity. So if there is the whiff of a chance that we're going to have a second wave, well, then that will increase the potential for additional easing. The one country that so far seems to be benefiting more than most is China from the lockdowns that it introduced. Government bonds there have been declining, and this is a clear trend in terms of the yield, where it has now broken the succession of lower rally highs, and it is back in the 3% level. Well, 3% is rather attractive from an international perspective because government bond yields elsewhere are considerably less. And then we also have the fact that the renminbi has been strengthening, but it was weaker in here today. So we have got a short-term overbought condition for the renminbi, but the most important thing is that it has broken its downtrend. This does suggest that the Chinese are willing to allow their currency to appreciate. Now, the potential for the renminbi to appreciate is likely to unshackle the potential for Asian currencies generally to also appreciate. So it is a rather significant development. One of the missing ingredients to emerging markets following gold higher has been the reticence of Asian governments to allow their currencies to appreciate. We have seen that an isolated number of currencies have been appreciating. The Taiwan dollar, for example, is right back on the region of its peaks, and so is the Korean won. But of course, they are also among the countries that have been doing best in terms of exports because of their focus on technology and the kinds of things that are required to remain productive in a stay-at-home world. Whether that will continue as we move further into the year is open to question, not least because the coronavirus pulled forward so many sales from in the future. And now the bigger point is what's going to be the next significant driver in terms of demand. We're certainly seeing that we've got a pause going on in the technology sector right now, and some of the very large cap shares have been pausing, whereas the industrial sector overall has been breaking out. And there is obviously then the potential that we're going to see more investment in renewables, more investment in infrastructure, more investment in housing. That's going to require a lot more spending. In order to get that spending done, then we need to get past the coronavirus. It might yet be a little early for that, but we are likely to have a lot of interesting news coming through in the next 6 weeks. Moderna has said that they could potentially have results from their phase 3 trial in October, but it might also be in November. Pfizer may also have the results from their trials as well. The Nasdaq Biotech Index has rebounded from the region of the trend mean. At the minimum, the bullish case is that we are seeing some additional interest coming through because the entire coronavirus challenge has been a proof of use case for new technologies. So we know that it's possible now to shorten the lead time to provide a new solution from years to months. And that is the kind of innovation that should be interesting to investors. The best case scenario would be if the regulatory environment is streamlined as well to give some additional credit to these companies that they can produce additional solutions. Now, of course, when we think about where the healthcare sector is overall and where government finances are overall, then the real big cost center and profit center in medicine is in chronic conditions. And the number of people, for example, that have diabetes and the way that diabetes progresses means that you need progressively more and higher doses of drugs in order to continue to benefit from them. Well, that has been revolutionary, for example, for Novo Nordisk, and that share is now consolidating rather well in the region of its previous peak. eventually we're going to have a genetic solution to diabetes, and that will then represent a very significant reduction in the ability of the diabetes cash flow market to benefit. So far, the healthcare sector is still at new highs. If we do in fact get a significant change and evolution of cures rather than treatments for chronic conditions, then it's going to be truly revolutionary for the healthcare sector. And it is something that is almost a needs must condition for countries that have got rather older populations. There's just no way that governments can continue to spend such large quantities of money on healthcare and subsidized healthcare without significant changes in the cost structure. Well, on the one hand, it's easy to provide a change in the cost structure through cutting wages, but there's no way that that is ever going to get through in terms of reducing living standards. We are just on the other side of that now. There is no tolerance in any sector to lower wages. And that means then that the clear onus for solutions is going to fall on technology. And that's most particularly true in healthcare because of the size of the problem and also the quantity of money that is going to be required in future to address it. So there is the real potential that we are going to have innovation in the biotech sector on a needs-must basis. And that, I think, will be something that could represent a very significant uptrend in biotechnology over the course of the next few years. Then the bigger question is, are we going to see the index just mess around for a while longer, or is it going to break out in the near term? I do think that we are still in an environment where we can anticipate some additional weakness. And the other point, of course, is that the stock market is about the best indicator we have of presidential elections in the USA. If it is likely that the incumbent is going to lose, then the stock market should decline into that decision. So we could have some additional volatility and easing for the next 6 weeks, with the potential then to get a bounce and a more aggressive attempt to reinflate the economy going forward. So there is short-term potential buying opportunities being set up with a medium-term outlook for what the next administration will prioritize. Then when we think about the global economy, it's very similar, because the big question is about whether the US dollar is going to continue to deteriorate. There are going to be two ways of looking at it. The first is that the weakness of the dollar is likely to contribute to a clear determination to invest elsewhere. That's already been part of the reason why gold has been performing. But I think it's particularly relevant that gold continues to do well in a whole host of currencies. And it's been finding support recently against the US dollar. It's still got a clear, consistent trend against the Brazilian real. It's still trending higher against the Canadian dollar, against the Swiss franc. It is in a very consistent consolidation. And in the Chinese renminbi, despite the fact that the renminbi has been strengthening, it is still trending higher and is still holding the breakout to new all-time highs. Even in India, where we've also had a meaningful rebound, we still have, in the rupee, we still have a clear uptrend for gold prices. So gold investors are benefiting from the clear determination of governments all over the world to devalue their currencies to deal with the massive challenge of recovery from the coronavirus. While the dollar does look like it is going to fall farthest and fastest, the ability of fiat currencies to hold their value against gold is very much in question. And the one thing that is very much in gold's favor is that it did nothing at all between about 2012 and 2019. Whereas when we look at the NASDAQ, for example, it has been going upwards for 12 years. Then when we look at gold in US dollars, it's only broken out to new all-time highs in the last 3 months. So it's quite natural that we should get some consolidation in this area around the big psychological 2000 level. We may even see some additional short-term volatility in order to close the overextension relative to the trend mean. But I think it's also worth thinking about gold on a purchasing power parity basis. Because when we look at it and adjust it for the purchasing power of the US dollar, then it puts the recent action into, I think, a much better perspective. When we think about gold and its purchasing power, then it has been going sideways for a lengthy period, and now it's pausing in the region of the peak from back in 2011. And that peak in 2011 was very similar to the peak we saw in 1980. I'm afraid it may not show the entire chart on the daily chart, but we can certainly see that the peak in 2011 was very similar to the peak values that we saw back in 1980. Now we're seeing it coming back up to these levels. Again, it's a natural area where we can anticipate some resistance, some consolidation, but I don't think anyone really thinks that governments are certain are about to gain new religion and become born-again fiscal austerity advocates. The rise of populism, whether that is on the left side, left wing or the right wing, it represents the breaking of the status quo. And the breaking of the status quo means that we're likely to lurch back and forth between extremes until a new status quo is delivered. But that is going to take time. And the reality is that we have got a massive amount of debt just about everywhere. So when we think about the quantity of debt, household debt to cash ratio, for example, well, the USA is in fact much better than the EU or the UK or Japan, where debt ratios tend to be very high relative to household cash. China is still holding a lot of cash relative to the USA, but when we then think about that in terms of the clear trend in terms of debt accumulation, I'm going to just start closing some of these so I can find the charts that I want faster. This was, I think, one of the most interesting ones, that China's household debt as a percentage of disposable income is rapidly now approaching that of the USA. A lot of the growth that China has achieved over the course of the last decade has been predicated on debt. And this is a chart of debt as a percentage of GDP. It's now in the region of 220%. Every time China has a crisis, then there's a massive increase in the quantity of debt. This, I think, is one of the bigger challenges. The more debt goes up, then we have to start thinking about why is it that China's government bond yields are rising when government bond yields all over the world are compressing. There has to be a reason for that. So perhaps it is the fact that China's debt is increasing at an increasing rate. Total bond issuance has been rising significantly over the course of the last few years. Now, what's also, I think, noteworthy is that total bond issuance had paused from about 2015, but it has upticked again as a result of the coronavirus. Then, when we think about the stock market, well, stocks have been extremely volatile on the mainland market. Now, the success of a small number of mega cap shares has, in many respects, I think, flattered the performance of Chinese shares. It does look like we're going to see additional upside from the Chinese market. They are clearly intent on inflating asset prices in much the same way that the Federal Reserve is willing to do the same thing. The quantity of debt outstanding in the global economy is likely to be a significant factor in global politics and global economics for at least the next decade. We're still in an environment of extraordinarily low interest rates. And the quantity of money that is being created and really being stored away by private equity is approaching $3 trillion. Now, we've certainly seen some deals being done by private equity over the course of the last few months. We've also seen that they have been more aggressive in listing stocks. The number of IPOs has increased substantially over the course of just the last few months. When we look at the IPO ETF, it's really gone haywire since March, and it pushed on again to new highs in here today. So, extraordinarily low interest rates put a premium on private assets because there is no discount rate. The continued ability of the technology sector and the private sector to generate profits is, or at least to generate positive returns, because profits have tended to be elusive, is very much predicated on the continuing low interest rate environment. Private equity is storing capital away because they are pretty sure that this environment will not last indefinitely. We know that corporate profits are under pressure, and without a significant increase in supply of money and credit over the course of the next 6 months, then the number of defaults will start to rise, the number of businesses that fail to reopen will start to weigh, and the emergency measures that were put in place to avoid those outcomes will run off for a majority of economies, and then debt will start to become an issue. Well, in order to get rid of that obvious challenge, then governments are going to have to increase the quantity of money in existence. The Federal Reserve has very clearly said this week that they want inflation. They're willing to do anything to achieve it. And that means that interest rates are going to stay low for a prolonged period. Valuations are already aggressive, they are likely to increase further. We're on the cusp of a bubble, and that is what we're seeing in terms of the private equity sector. Now, they are achieving very aggressive multiples for the businesses that are being listed. There was a lot of news this week about Snowflake being a very successful IPO. There is the listing of a Magic Mushrooms company in the UK, which is likely to be oversubscribed and going to create a valuation in billions. And of course, you could, I think, argue that you'd have to be high in order to buy some of these things, but the reality is that when you've got extraordinarily liquid environments where there is no discount rate against which to measure potential growth, then any price is justifiable. I had an email last week, I published it in comment of the day, from a private equity investor whose first fund was closed, I think, about 18 months ago for about 2 million. His second fund closed for about 10 million. And the third fund, which he's raising money for now, is 100 million. So these types of 10x moves are not impossible in the private markets. But they're extraordinarily interest rate sensitive. That's perhaps the most important factor, that the higher prices go, the more alluring they become to investors, the rush that people have to buy into these promising stories. That will continue as long as interest rates are low. But when we have a situation where there is a symbiotic relationship between the government and the central bank, and modern monetary theory becomes de rigueur and obvious, then that does seed inflationary pressures. Velocity of money is not updated all that often. It's updated with a 3 month delay and a 3 month lag. So the measure that we had for the update in June was for the end of March. And what we've seen is a very significant deterioration. And it's been trending downwards since 1997. So this is obviously very much in tune with the internet and e-commerce and the disintermediation, which has been a very significant factor in the global economy for the last 25 years. But the quantity of money that's being injected into the economy and the potential that we're going to have economic recovery, whether it is because of the economy simply opening up because it can no longer be kept closed, whether it is because we get vaccines that accelerate the entire process, or whether we get a very significant infrastructure and energy investment drive from governments and private equity, then it is likely that the velocity of money will at least recover back up to where it was at the beginning of this year. And when that happens with the quantity of money that has been printed, then we potentially have inflation. The one limiting factor on inflation after the 2008 crisis was that banks were not lending. I thought it was really quite interesting this week that Europe is talking about removing the moratorium on paying dividends for European banks. Of course, they didn't talk about the fact that in order to pay dividends, you need profits. And European banks don't have any because of the low interest rate environment, because they have negative interest rates. Eventually, we will start to see some of these issues being addressed. We will start to see that there will be more impetus to drive rates higher, but not until we start to see economies improving. The Main Street Lending Program in the US, The Main Street Lending Program in the US is perhaps the most, I think, meaningful change we've had in banking in at least a decade, because it clearly circumvents the credit and departments of the banking sector. And it is basically transferring money directly from the central bank to businesses. Now, that pushing of credit and the creation of a credit lending facility without the determination of banks on whether it's a good idea or a bad idea is also directly inflationary. They have been very slow to get that program underway. But if we do start to see that credit and the willingness to accept credit increases, then that is going to be inflationary. And it means then that the bubbly environment we have today in private equity, which is in, I think, many respects being mirrored in the IPO market and in the highly levered, unprofitable portion of the technology sector. Those sectors are extraordinarily interest rate sensitive. On the other hand, if we are going to have inflationary pressures, then commodities are trading at levels on a relative basis that haven't been seen in 100 years. So that's an additional point that, on a relative basis, the resources sector, the industrial sector, are trading at significant discounts, and the energy sector is trading at historic lows. But energy has got significant challenges that need to be addressed before those companies can really start to represent value plays. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I'll wish all the best to all of you.